No, you can take the terrorist thing out if you think that's too much.
I don't know. I thought that was great.
Hello and welcome to the Cambie Report. It is 186 days until the October 20th, 2018 Vancouver municipal election. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
We have a fantastic episode for you today. We have an interview with Francis Beulah, the noted local journalist.
We had actually put a whole bunch of stories in our show notes about like the NPA's worst week so far this year.
Yeah. Well, although, I mean, yeah.
We want to talk about these, but the interview with Francis was actually so fun and so interesting and so informative that we are going to present that to you in its unabridged form and get to some of these other stories in the future. So please bear with us. We will talk about these things, absolutely.
And we touch on some of it.
Yes, we do. But you're going to really love this interview with Francis.
Well, let's just throw it over to Francis now.
Okay.
So, Francis Beulah, welcome to Cambie Report. We wanted to sit down and talk with you a bit about what it's like being a journalist here in the city of Vancouver. So perhaps just to start, for those who aren't aware of your body of work, maybe just sort of give us a very quick high-level summary of who you are and why people, I think, have a lot of respect for your work.
Or don't.
Or don't.
I did not start out intending to be a journalist. I have a degree in French literature, and I entered UBC studying music, and then I became a commercial fisherman, and then finally around the age of 28 realized I needed to make a living and thought about a whole bunch of different things and ended up in journalism. And my first job was at the Creston Valley Advance, and my first day was the general strike of 1983. And I didn't really know what I was doing, but I picked up a notebook and a piece of paper and thought or a pen, and I thought I should leave the building, I think that's what I'm supposed to do.
Generally, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so that was the beginning. And I did cover city councils there, and I remember it was kind of fun, you know, and there'd be these crazy stories involving raccoons or, you know, people's septic fields way out in the middle of nowhere or something like that. And I came to realize that council was a great place for these very human stories. Like, you wouldn't think of it, but it is. And I tell my students now, I teach a course in civic reporting at Langara College's journalism department, and I always say, if you think that covering the city means going to awful meetings where, you know, pale white men in gray suits make terrible decisions or not incomprehensible decisions about infrastructure and, other arcane things like that, you're missing the boat. Like, the city is just this collection, when you finally clue into it, this funneling point for all kinds of passions about how the city should run and what should happen on the streets. And, you know, I've seen delegations show up to demand that no street trees be planted because, you know, of some belief they have about how horrible street trees will be. And you hear amazing things when you go to public hearings at the city. It is so much about people and not necessarily about, it is about policy, obviously, but but really about people. And that's what I try to convey to my students, and I hope, you know, comes out in some of the reporting that I do. So I started out in Creston. I worked at a few other papers. I came to the Vancouver Sun in 1987, and I became the City Hall reporter in 1994. And I am what is known as a beat reporter. There's GA, general assignment. The funniest line for many of us in the movie The Post was when, you know, the person leaking the Pentagon Papers walks up to this guy and says, you know, are you someone important? And he said, I'm a general assignment reporter. And every journalist in the audience broke out laughing. So anyway, there's general assignment reporters and there's beat reporters. So I've always enjoyed being a beat reporter because I love feeling like I have some body of knowledge I can draw on. So I don't have to just accept whatever anyone tells me. Like the thing I didn't like about being a general assignment reporter is you phone on one topic one night, another night, and people can tell you anything they want.
Because you don't have the background. You don't have the information from being around to know.
Exactly.
But no, that's not how it actually is.
Yeah. So, you know, as a beat reporter, you become kind of an institutional repository, a kind of Fahrenheit 451 book of what's happened. And so when someone says, oh no, we can't possibly do that, you can say, but you voted in favor of it 3 years ago, or you know, these five other cities are doing it, or whatever. You just have more knowledge to be able to challenge people.
Interesting. So with that, I guess you mentioned before we started recording that I think you've been the beat reporter at City Hall since 94. Was that correct?
That's right.
So I guess you've been there longer than any of the counselors. You've been there longer than any of the most of the senior staff, I would imagine, at this point.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There are some people who have at City Hall still who've been there longer than me. But no, 94. And I was the City Hall reporter for The Sun from 94 till 2008. And then, as I always like to say, decided to start a freelance career on the day the recession started. So since 2008, I've been primarily freelancing for the Globe and Mail. But at you know, for about 8 years, I had a column in the Vancouver magazine. I write for BC Business. I've written for, you know, occasional publications back east.
So do you find, like, our city councilor, our councilors asking, not to name names out of school, but do city councilors come up to ask you how things work sometimes?
They don't generally. I mean, and for a good reason, because, you know, unbeknownst to many of you, but when someone's elected, they spend about 2 weeks taking them through little classes about how City Hall works.
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah, and I got to sit in on that.
Is that run by the city manager,
No, it's run by all the staff.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got to sit in on that when the Cope Council was elected. I spent, you know, a week kind of going to classes with them. And so they learn a lot of things about arcane stuff at the city, the property endowment fund, which nobody ever understands. And every new counselor always comes in thinking that Vancouver's famous property endowment fund is this magical box of $1 billion. And then staff are like, yeah, 80% of it, there's social housing on it, on leased land, or, you know.
Right.
So it's a learning experience for them. I do have people... I've had several people ask me if they should run for mayor.
I guess that's
over the years.
It's a good barometer for them to figure out where their, or temperature taker to figure out where their name recognition is.
Yeah. Or just, you know, what I think their popular images or their public images. I mean, I'm one of many people they would ask and so on. But you know, sometimes. And I'm not the only one who does this, but sometimes there's a group of us who've been reporting on City Hall for a while. So sometimes we'll gently point out in a tweet, this isn't really how property taxes work, actually, in spite of what Councillor so-and-so is saying.
Yeah, property taxes haven't been spiraling upwards for 10 years. No, it's...
Or property that, you know, as you know... Yeah. The biggest mistake everybody makes about property taxes is they think if your assessment goes up, then your property taxes go up by that much. They don't understand how property taxes work.
It's mind-boggling to me that people don't realize that. Like, we've had assessments go up by how much over the last 10 years, and no one's gold-plated City Hall yet. You know, it's not like City Hall's rolling in cash. And so
people think they do. And they do see their taxes go up. And it's true that, you know, in some areas of the city, they'll go up by more than the 3% or whatever the city.
Like my neighborhood in the Olympic Village, which has been going up
because their
faster.
Assessments went up so much more than anyone else's in the city. So, but, you know, it's easy to blame people for not knowing more. And sometimes I admit I'll get a little, you know, kind of exasperated and like, as I've said the previous 10 times, you know, or whatever, some little passive aggressive thing like that. But really, people are busy. They don't have time to sit and study City Hall policy all day long. They've got Kinder Morgan pipeline they have to follow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've got, you know, they have to keep on top of President Trump's latest tweet, you know, and run their own lives. So.
Well, and I imagine one thing you've seen covering City Hall so long is like the same debates come up again and again. Are there any of those that kind of stand or do things change?
They do. And for me, that's been kind of a revelation, which things change and which things don't. Mm. Like for me, one of the most interesting changes was in 2003, when Cope got elected with Larry Campbell as the mayor, and within 6 months of being elected, Larry Campbell and the council said, by the way, basement suites throughout the city are legal.
Yeah, we were talking about that before we were recorded, because I was asking about it, because I had thought that they legalized it in 89, and I didn't realize, as you said when we were talking about it, that every all of the 22 communities got to vote on whether or not they would legalize suites in their own little community. And then 10 years went by of that. I had just assumed, I mean, you know, as an early 30s millennial type, I just assumed that basement suites have always been legal.
It was a huge battle. And, you know, no municipality in the Lower Mainland was legalizing them. There were battles going on everywhere. Delta, Surrey, you name it.
Well, I think Surrey did it in 94 or 95 or something. It was much later. It was even later than Vancouver.
I doubt it was even then, you know, because as I'm saying, Vancouver didn't legalize them till 2003. Oh, that's right, So, you know, and for throughout, as you say, the late 80s and all through the 90s, there were constant battles over secondary suites and fights over, you know, like, was this allowing the wrong kind of people to move into the neighborhood? And what about parking? And what about, you know, this and what about that? And all of a sudden, in 2003, they say, oh, they're all legal. No one says a peep. Nobody comes to City Hall. Mm-hmm. No one does anything. And I just thought, oh, my God, things really do change in 10 years. On the other hand, a thing I like to point out is TransLink was formed in about 2000. So for 18 years, we've had a fight over the extra layer of funding that TransLink needs in order to pay for transportation improvements. They've got enough money to run the system as is, but not enough money for improvements. So for 18 years, in that time, America elected a black president, legalized gay marriage, brought in a completely new healthcare system. Mm-hmm. We still haven't been able to figure out how to get that extra layer of transit funding in. No. We're still arguing over that, and I feel like I'm going to go to my grave.
Well, and still, even now with the new agreement, that's still just an agreement for this 10-year plan. It's not a permanent.
That's right.
It's not a permanent funding.
So the next one is going to be the mobility pricing fight, and it's going to be fascinating to see. You know, what's happened in the past is that, you know, there have been funding suggestions made on a regular basis. When TransLink was first created, the suggestion was to have a $75 vehicle levy.
And that basically killed the BCNDP in 2000. Well, I mean, well, that among a few other things.
They were dead anyways. But, you know, somehow they thought they might get a few extra votes if they didn't put in the vehicle levy. Yeah. So they chickened out. You know, there were various other suggestions made to the Liberal government over the years. They sort of chickened out on most of them, except a tiny increase in the gas tax when Blair Leckstrom was the minister. But basically, every time they've come up to the start line and it's been time to pull the trigger and come up with a new funding formula, no one wants to take the political hit.
Right.
So that's an example of a debate that's gone on with very little change over the years.
So I guess with that, in terms of the years, in City Hall itself, in the City Hall, the council meetings and things like that, to my eye, having been paying attention to it for a couple of years now at most, the decorum there is fairly low. Has it always been like that? Is it, you know, back when Cope was battling the NPA in the 90s, has it always been that way, that councillors would yell at each other, councillors would be, you know, having their fights in the room?
Well, I actually think it's not as bad as the provincial legislature or the House
fair.
Of Commons.
I guess that's probably fair.
I don't know. I know that's a low bar, but I mean, it's not bad. And if you go to committee meetings, actually, at any of the city councils, usually there's quite a civilized discussion, actually. It's more at the formal, televised, we know this is going out live streaming kind of meetings that you get more of that. And it's kind of always been like that.
Right.
I remember there was a point at which it was 10 NPA to Jenny Kwan for Cope on council. And, you know, every time she made a motion and they wanted to defeat it, not only would they vote against it, but every one of them felt the need to stand up and say something scathing about how stupid she was, or,
oh, wow,
you know, the equivalent of that. I've seen many vision counselors, you know, sort of launch into what appear to be pointless, somewhat passive aggressive attacks on, you know, their co-counselors. So it's not unusual to have a certain amount of bickering. I have to say there's a certain dynamic on council with a few counselors that has made it a little bit worse the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely see that as there's a bit of grandstanding that's been happening, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, people know it's televised, and I don't know why they stand up and sometimes say things, and you're just like, this doesn't really look that good on camera. Why are you doing this?
Well,
but they think it does.
Who's even watching? I'm watching oftentimes.
Do. People
but,
do.
Yeah.
No.
You're,
okay.
not, you're not alone. We have a few hundred listeners. One of the I think that is driving more people to watch right now is how this election feels sort of
different
or bigger.
Yeah, it is.
Gregor's not running again. You know, a mayor for 8 years.
Well, no one's
a bit
running
of
again.
Big vacuum. A bunch of the councilors are stepping down.
Yeah.
Is our perception right? Is this a different election?
It's the most unusual election, civic election I've covered, because not only are many people not running again, but you're basically seeing the complete kind of fraying of the party structure, in part because of the whole fundraising issue. They don't know how they're going to raise money. You know, in the past,
right.
You know, last time Vision rose 3.5 million and the NPA rose 2.5. Well, that kind of holds a party together.
When the NPA got, you know, of that 2.5, didn't the NPA get a solid $1 million from just Rob McDonald alone?
No, it was, I think, 470 from Peter Armstrong and another couple hundred from Rob.
Yeah, and you certainly...
I think Rob the time before.
Right, oh, it was the time before that. Yeah, that's right. When he made the bet with
Peter Wall.
Yeah. But it really does seem like... that era is gone by far, as the era where one or two people could essentially bankroll a political party.
That's right. Or, you know, or a particular set of donors like developers or unions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, particularly in Vancouver, it just feels like a completely new game because no one's quite sure how they're going to raise the money. There are very few incumbents left to sort of ensure that a particular party continues to get a majority. It feels so wide open. It's incredible. Like, I know that on Twitter someone said, ask Francis who's going to win. And, you know, if I even knew who the candidate for one or the other side would be, I'd be thrilled with myself. Mm-hmm. It's just so uncertain at this point. I just feel like we're in this maze with no idea where the end is.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think we've even gotten all of the current councillors determined whether they're running again, even.
I think it's pretty clear
at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
is there any surprises?
Raymond Louis, Heather Deal, maybe Elizabeth Ball. I'd be pretty surprised if Melissa DeGenova didn't run again, and Adrian Carr probably as a councillor. But that's not very many as incumbents.
No. Mm-hmm. You don't think that Adrian Carr will run for mayor? I imagine we'll get to that later, but...
I think that the people are very worried that she wouldn't win, that she'd split the left vote, the NPA would get in, and then the Greens would have lost their top vote-getter on council.
Yeah, and I know from contacts in the public sector unions, the Vancouver City Worker unions anyways, that they're very worried about an NPA mayor, because I think the line that I keep hearing, and I guess this is their brand, is that when there's an NPA mayor, there's a city strike. And I don't know how accurate that comment is.
That's not always true, but obviously they feel that they don't have the same channels as they do when, Vision or Cope is in. Yeah.
With previous elections, this election is different, but do you see candidates stepping forward as early as this? Or has there been a change where it feels like the parties are also trying to be a bit more open about their nomination processes?
No, I mean, when there's going to be a big change like there is now, like when Philip Owen was in his last term with the NPA in the 1999 to 2002 term. By January of that year, the party was fracturing because they wanted him to say what he was doing, and some people wanted him out. So as of, you know, January on, there was a lot of tension in the party because they needed to figure out what was going on. That year, they didn't announce Larry Campbell as the Cope candidate until September.
Oh, wow.
Amazingly. That that's because I think they just hadn't found someone.
Right.
And it's so funny that that late that he would be pulled in and to be that formative a mayor, because I think, you know, the reverberations of his being mayor, not even necessarily the things that he did as mayor, but, you know, creating like the vision party coming out of that is such a game changer for Vancouver for the last.
But you could see that that was coming. I mean, the NPA had been in for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, Gordon Campbell had, you know, his terms as mayor, and then Philip Owen was in for three terms. So, you know, there was a seismic shift coming. And also, the NDP had lost in the previous year in the provincial election. And there's sort of a conventional wisdom in Vancouver is that when the NDP is in power in Victoria, then the city elects NPA. And vice versa.
I guess that's a bad sign for the lefties then right now.
It is. Well, and part of it is just logistics because, you know, the NDP has now sucked up, you know, anyone with any political skills and carted them off to Victoria.
Yeah, absolutely.
What actually a lot of people have been surprised at in this election is they expected all of these suddenly unemployed Liberals to be flooding into Vancouver and to be landing on the NPA as, you know, a good political base and a place where they would put their efforts. And that doesn't seem to be happening for reasons people can't quite understand.
Well, I feel like they might just be demoralized in a way that, I mean, I guess you can't really say that they're more demoralized than the NDP were in 2001.
Because the NPA
now? Yeah, the Liberals now, the BC Liberals, you know, they're staffers. But I think,
they've still got 44 people.
Unlike the two. Yeah, so I mean, I guess it's interesting that we're not seeing those sort of former Liberal staffers coming into Vancouver necessarily in the numbers that we would have thought. But with I don't know how many parties there are. I haven't checked today how many parties there are on the left. Are there any more that have been created in the last couple of days? But we're at
I heard
something
about
like,
one. Yeah, well, there was
Pro
Bank
now. There was another one. Or something.
What's it called?
Pro Vancouver or something like that. I don't actually know if they're on the left
my
or right.
My husband was
or
telling
what,
me about some new party, and I was just like, oh, my God.
It's like Alberta syndrome. You end up getting, you know, this endless fracturing of parties on the left.
So do you think that there's do you think they're going to be able to come up with a plan to work together?
The parties on the left?
Yeah.
No, that's what we're all waiting to see. That's the big mystery. I mean, will the desire to keep the NPA out be enough to bring them together? Or is there just so much ego or a fundamental political difference going on between the parties that they're not going to be able to get a substantial group to agree? Because really, what you need is the remnants of Vision Vancouver and the Greens to be able to, you have to have those two together. And the problem.
Not necessarily one city, because they seem to have numbers in support.
They just don't have the brand that the Greens
sense.
Do. The Greens could get a carrot elected. You know, it has a strong brand. It's a worldwide brand.
Right.
They hardly have to do any advertising. Everyone understands what the Green Party is, especially now that Andrew Weaver and company have been elected in Victoria. So one city has only elected one school board trustee. If you went out and did a poll, the vast majority, and I think Mario Canseco's poll showed
it.
One city, people don't know who it is, and they've only got a certain amount of time until October and a limited amount of money. So the two parties on the center left with the strongest name recognition are Vision and the Greens. In spite of what some people think, I think there's still a core of people who are willing to vote for Vision because they don't they see them as the most pragmatic of the progressive parties. I know many, many people in the Twitterverse would disagree with that. I'm prepared for your slings and arrows.
Well, and I make the point a lot on this podcast that they also have a huge, huge component of really experienced staff.
Yes, and a huge database.
And yeah, that database is, although I was wondering about that the other day. I was talking to somebody within Vision even, and we were talking about how accurate that database is now.
Accurate enough to get 80,000 people out in 2014.
Yeah, but the question I think was more, in the last 4 years has Vision's brand become so damaged that that database of information of who is or isn't a supporter of Vision is now not accurate anymore.
Right, yeah, because so many have fallen away. Mm.
But it does give contact information and everything.
Right, like I mean, they have been a party for more than a decade, and there is a core group of people who support them. So you need those two to agree, and then, but they're the people also who have, in some ways, it's hard for them to cooperate because they each want to protect their own brand and their own parties, you know, established history and so on. So, I mean, I'm going to be fascinated to see if they can work something out. I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of people around trying to get a collaborative deal going, but whether that can happen, I don't know.
So do you think that the fear of the NPA and what the NPA might do is salient enough and real enough for that kind of nucleation of some kind of coalition on the left to actually
happen? I just don't know that it is, because for a lot of people, Vision is the equivalent of the NPA. So any collaboration with Vision, you know, their fear of the NPA is a fear of Vision.
Yeah, you really hear that, is that yes. overlap of, yep. of, you know, Vision is just as bad or
yes,
whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
The Swanson camp is putting that out there. And that's the one thing we totally forgot to talk about with Mario, is that Swanson's name recognition or positives or whatever you want to frame it as. We were talking about the limits of that poll with you before, but Swanson was up there. Like people,
she's been around for 30
yeah.
years.
Yeah, didn't she run for mayor in 88?
Yeah, yes. 86. So,
86, yeah.
But
yeah.
she is steadfast, no cooperation with Vision, and has a team around her.
Well, and that's going to be, I think, the real tough part with each of the parties or each of the different wings of the left trying to figure out is, you know, some parts of the left will work with Vision but won't work with COPE. Some parts of the left will work with Vision but won't work with the Greens, or vice versa.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I mean, another thing that people haven't talked about too much, but it's a fundamental question that has to be resolved. So this election is going to be about housing, homelessness, development.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. The Greens, it's very unclear what their housing development position is going to be, because Adrienne Carr has taken pretty populist positions for her 7 years on council. I think she's probably voted against more development projects than any other councillor in the history of Vancouver.
And often for reasons that don't necessarily jive well with the left, too, right? She'll vote against them because there's not enough parking, or she'll vote against them because it's too tall, or, you know, these things that, you know,
disrupts the character of the neighborhood and so on. So, yeah, so, you know, if Vision and the Greens are going to collaborate or cooperate, how are they going to do that, given that Vision... Most people I talk to in Vision, they still believe that there is a role for development and that, you know, this city has to accommodate growth. And the Greens, it's not really clear what their position is, because they've been in opposition. And so they voted against a lot of things, and it's not clear what they would support.
So do you think that, so I have a question in two parts. One, do you think that the Greens have some fear, you know, rational or not, of what I will call liberal Democrat syndrome, where being the junior partner in a coalition will end up like just destroying their brand and eliminating their chance of actually electing a mayor
and
in the future?
Watching everything roll out in Victoria would only accentuate that.
And then the other part...
On the other hand, it's not clear that even though they have a good, strong brand... Whether they, and in fact, they seem to not want a majority. I believe that I've heard that they're not going to run enough councillors to get a majority. So they don't want a majority. So then what is the strategy?
Right. Well, the Greens have worked with the NPA quite a bit on park board and on school board.
Yeah.
Do you think that the type of NPA that we end up getting after the NPA nomination meeting is going to be a catalyst for whether or not the left is actually going to be able to coalesce? Like, do you think that seeing people like Adrienne Crook and Hector Bremner get elected as the NPA nominees would spur on more or less impetus to coalesce on the left than electing John Cooper and the slate of Park Board people who are already there?
No, I mean, it's, you know, not everyone's had a chance to articulate all their positions yet, so it's hard to say where everything would fall. But, you know, Hector Bremner and Adrian Crook are kind of going into the YIMBY. You know, they're appealing to younger voters in the city, the people who feel shut out of home ownership, shut out of the West Side, and so on, sort of the YIMBY group. That is something that's also vision would appeal to as well. So where the Greens and Cope in one city would line up against relation to that, it's hard. They would oppose.
When one city's even gone, and one city is actively talking about rezoning large swaths of the city now, too. Mm. It's funny how much sort of the abundant housing crew has really, and I think we're going to get to it, has really changed everybody's minds, or like at least forced everybody to really look at that issue that I think was a third rail for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think, so as we're waking our way through the parties, do you think that one city is building itself in terms of its capacity to a point where it's really becoming? I feel like they're almost the new Vision in waiting, the party that broke away from Cope, just like Vision did, the party that's got, you know, a bunch of organizers that worked for years in the city. And now they've got the numbers. I mean, their meeting on Saturday had 70 members come out to it.
Whoa.
Which, I mean, to my mind, an April meeting in Vancouver.
Okay, maybe you're excited about that. I mean, it's okay, but there's a lot of work to go
absolutely.
To get 80,000 votes.
MPA meet and greets are pulling similar numbers
Actually,
to
that's
that.
True. And Vision's AGM had 70 as well, approximately, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's respectable. It shows they're getting somewhere. But to think that in any way that means that they're ready to, like, take over city council.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. I'm just wondering if they're maybe positioning themselves well for it in the future.
I mean, they could. I know that there are still some people on the further left who say that they're just, you know, Vision.
they're just a rebrand.
A rebrand of Vision and so on. But I think that they've made it pretty clear what their positions are and that they don't agree with Vision on a lot of development issues. So, you know, there's a possibility there.
And then I guess the last party really on the left that we're dealing with now is Cope still a thing?
Well, we got an email from Cope because we didn't talk about them in the last episode.
It's true.
So.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, Vancouver, the Cope would not be a thing in any other municipality, but in Vancouver, which has like a history of very left-wing politics and, you know, having a fairly radical left, I mean, I think there is, you know, Cope is there. It has a function. It has a role. And there are still people who really, you know, believe in that. And Gene Swanson's campaign in the by-election in October really convinced a lot of people, like, that, yes, this still has life in it and so on. So.
Well, but I found it really interesting that she opted to go for an independent run on that by-election rather than, and sort of just allow Cope to trail, you know, hang on her
Yeah, I'm not
almost.
Sure what that was about. I think it might have been her just wanting to get out early, and then rather than go through then a nomination in Cope just came along and endorsed her. And pretty clear that everyone who supports her, diagram, the Venn circles between Cope and Gene Swanson supporters, I don't think they're very far apart.
Well, I think all the Cope supporters are Gene Swanson supporters,
yes,
but not all the Swanson supporters know what Cope is, especially the younger ones. And I think what Swanson did with her launch was really build this, like, network of young socialists,
the
essentially.
The Gene Machine is what I heard it quoted as on the weekend.
And those are the people who are our age and younger who don't necessarily remember
the era.
But she'll
just bring them
Cope.
Over to Cope if necessary. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, like...
So then that's all the sort of the lefty parties, and then that leaves sort of this NPA that we don't know necessarily what it's going to be yet, whether it's going to be sort of more of that historic look of it with John
Well,
Cooper
I mean,
or...
for both sides, if you want to call it that, there is this profound revolution going on because they can't just battle the way they used to be. Like, you know, if you'll recall, it used to be NPA was the party of development, you know, tight budgets, not fixing the downtown east side, not dealing with the drug crisis, you know, and things like that. And Vision, or
We're
going to
get more emails from Sam.
Well, yeah, okay. Yep. Sam was different. He was his own person who did things in a different way. Okay. And that was them recognizing some of their mistakes of the past. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Vision or COPE was, you know, well, more so Vision, was this new party that was going to handle development, but in a different way that benefited the city, that had more sensitivity to the downtown east side. I'm not saying I believe any of this. I'm just saying how they were marketing themselves. That was going to, you know, just be kinder and gentler and so on. So both of those parties are undergoing a profound identity crisis because the NPA has to figure out a different way to deal with development. They can't just be the party that, like, vote for us, we're responsible, we'll make sure that, you know, your taxes are low and there's development, but not too much. And Vision, obviously, has, or whoever emerges in their place, has to take a different stance because clearly everyone is in an uproar in the city. Yeah. It feels like something has to change.
It is funny that buzz that we have in the city right now that something needs to give. Like housing has become such a thing that, you know, everyone
people
is
are
now
angry about it
and like really angry.
Well, that was the joke someone told me that they're tweeting out during the by-election is like on election day, they're like, I can't make up my mind between Hector Bremner and Jean Swanson.
Jen St. Dennis, who is a reporter at Metro, did that. And to me, that perfectly epitomizes the dilemma in the city that people have is that they're very frustrated. They're very angry. They feel the real estate situation is not working for them. And do they go with a kind of eat the rich, you know, candidate or someone who says, let's eat the rich, but in a slightly different way. Let's go in and rezone their neighborhoods.
should City Hall eat the rich or should the market eat the rich?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Free the rich to get eaten by the market.
Yeah, and I mean, that is really funny because like I was a ballot box voter as well. Mm-hmm. Like for the first time in my life, I walked into the little booth there and I didn't know who I was voting for. And it wasn't for me. It wasn't even between two candidates. It was between three candidates. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't sure.
And I think that's going to happen in this election as well. I think that, if I had a prediction, and I'm notoriously bad, don't ever bet on anything I say.
You haven't seen our podcast, Podkeep Our Lands, predictions that we've put out over the last year.
Yeah. Oh,
consistently
you're wrong.
We
have been very, very wrong
so
in the past.
So I think we could end up with a council that looks somewhat like the school board does now, where it's a mix of NPA Green, maybe in one city, and maybe Vision, and it won't be totally clear how this group is going to coalesce and do anything because it'll be so, there will be no one in charge.
So have you heard anything, you know, in terms of scuttlebutt about the current state of the NPA nomination race? Do you think the forces of the old guard or the forces of, for lack of a better word, YIMBYism, are going to emerge victorious?
Yeah, it's hard to say what the actual issues are. Some seem personality driven. There was, I can't remember the name of the account. It's one of those real estate is, you know, something or another accounts. But that person who clearly knows what's going on said, you know, the internal battles in the NPA are going to be epic this year.
And they have been so far.
We haven't heard too much about it. It's hard to report on because all the different factions aren't necessarily being completely open. Although in some of my stories, if you read some of the comments that some councillors make or some candidates make about others, like Kupar talked about, oh, we can't just have hashtags as housing policy. Oh, I wonder who you could be referring to there, you know. And
but also you can. And that is how like
Gene.
That's the entire Swanson, that is how premise
people,
of Vision.
That is how people under 35 communicate. Yeah. Like, and I'm not even being derogatory to millennials like me. Like, we do operate that way. Like, he's that just seems out of touch.
Yeah. So anyway, you have John Kupar kind of making negative remarks about Hector Bremner. Hector Bremner and Glenn Chernin have each made negative remarks about each other. Yeah. Now we have this new person in the race who's never been involved in politics before, Mr. Rosemary Roxall.
Yeah, Mr. Rosemary, yeah, that's the only thing I've got. Well, he was endorsed by Chip Wilson, which has got to be a kiss of death if is one.
Oh, no.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Anyway, so so I think it's partly an old guard, younger thing for sure, but it's also a split between sort of the traditional NPA, like, of course, we support development, it's what drives our economy, versus, you know, they're like some of those and traditional NPA voters in Dunbar and Carisdale hate the new Dunbar and Carisdale because they feel it's been taken over by foreign investors and all the rest. So they've become completely unsympathetic about development.
Mm-hmm. Well, and those posters that were up on Dunbar that were like attack of the 80-foot buildings and things like that. There really is that fight there.
Right. So you have within, as I'm saying, within both, on both sides, there's a struggle over what to do about housing and development. And there's a split within both sides on that. Yeah. And it's really unclear at this point, like, who's going to emerge on each side and what kind of a banner they're going to carry.
Who do you think is better positioned in terms of the left or the right to capitalize? Because the left has their fractured party situation, but has, you know, some enthusiasm and some good candidates. And the right has...
NPA is still at least a party.
Okay.
And, you know, when you're together as a party, sometimes you can just go into a small room in the back and kind of, you know,
work things out,
mm-hmm. as they say. You know, and traditionally people on the right have been somewhat more willing to compromise in order to just get a candidate they can unify behind. Whereas, you know, I think history has shown us for 150 years, including, I just saw the death of Stalin.
I saw that.
I really want to see that.
Yeah. But, you know, people on the left become very doctrinaire about their positions and sort of, you know, not willing to compromise for fear that it will be the slippery slope to, you know, neoliberalism or whatever.
It's almost like they'd rather lose but be right than win and not.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, there are people out there in some of those parties who absolutely hold that position. It's far better to lose and be right
If you ask them,
than to get into power and do things.
Yeah, I can only imagine if you ask your average COPE, like real COPE supporter. And
COPE,
I think
they're COPE apparatchik.
Yeah, I don't think there are very many COPE, like not very hardcore COPE supporters left. But if you ask like a real hardcore COPE supporter, you know, would you rather win in a coalition with Vision or lose and have the NPA dominate? I'm fairly certain they'd probably say they'd be okay with the NPA.
Mm-hmm. Or there's almost that, you know, optimistic, well, if we just get to run the pure campaign this time, the revolution will happen.
Mm-hmm. It's coming. Well, you know, like we laugh, but it is coming.
Well,
we go with the amount of anger that's out there. There's the hope that...
I mean, the one thing that's on the side of, you know, or that the one factor that's working is there's a lot of angry people who want to see a housing solution, but it can't be purely market-driven.
No.
And on the other hand, you can't just turn around and say, oh, you know, dear city and provincial governments, can you take every dollar you have and put it into social housing?
But, like, which revolution do you think we're going to end up getting? Clement Attlee or Margaret Thatcher?
Well, and that's the real thing is, you know, if let's say Hector Bremner becomes mayor and he gets to rezone all of the city and he rezones it all for 6, 7, 10-story buildings... that doesn't
largely market,
and that doesn't change anything. Yeah,
and I think that's
20
what people,
to 30 years of building.
That's what I think that's what people are worried about, because, you know, everyone I've talked to who's thoughtful and has looked at the housing situation has said we can't solve this housing problem solely with government tools. You know, we can't restrict demand enough, and we cannot spend enough money to provide everyone who needs it with you know, subsidized housing, you know, so that they're only paying $350, you know, a month in rent. So you can't do that. On the other hand, if you leave things completely to the market, which is kind of what's happened, you know, more or less in Vancouver up until recently. And I would exclude the Rental 100 policy from that, because that was Vision's first attempt to kind of change things. But if you leave it completely to the market, what you're going to do, especially in a supply constrained situation like Vancouver, is they will build for the people they can sell to the most easily. And who are those people?
Yep.
Investors who want one bedrooms and studios that they can rent out easily, and high-end condos.
My landlord.
So do you think that money laundering has a particular influence on the market in Vancouver? Like, the
you know, if I knew that, they would make me God.
You'd have a Pulitzer.
Yes, exactly. I don't think anyone really knows. I mean, obviously, in Vancouver for a long time, there's always been these suspicions that things other than normal economics drive the market. Yeah. And I remember writing a story almost for Van Meg almost 10 years ago about, you know, does drug money fuel the market? And then, you know, I had people looking at, is there enough billions produced by the marijuana market in BC to actually fundamentally alter the housing market in Vancouver? I mean, I know people want to believe that. I know they want to believe that it's all because of mainland Chinese criminals. I think that it's really difficult to say that is the main drive. That's the only driver. Certainly you don't want that kind of thing in your city in any case, even if it has no effect on the housing market. But, you know, we're in a situation where we have a very complex, weird housing market that's happening around the world, by the way. I was just in Boston at a land use policy conference, and there were reporters from all over the states, and there were experts from all over the states. The situation of the price of housing escalating far beyond any increases in average salaries is happening in every city that's not Cleveland or Detroit. So, you know, every city is dealing with this. People are angry over it. They don't totally understand it. And in different cities, different, you know, kind of causes are being pegged. You know, in San Francisco, it's evil Google, and Amazon, you know, and Seattle, it's evil Amazon. In Vancouver, it's evil foreign investors. But housing markets are super complex and dynamic, and all kinds of things going on there.
I was listening to one podcast
earlier.
I
await the Twitter response.
Oh, for sure. I know I was listening to one podcast earlier today where they were talking about, like, corruption and Trump, and they were talking about how easy it is once you get in, move from that, like, development to just, like, slapping your name on things to move money around the world, because when you start a new development, you need to have a bunch of liquid cash, and governments don't tend to look too closely if you're bringing in a couple $1 million to bring, you know, start hiring architects to design a building or something. And that's how they were sort of tying that.
Yeah, I think.
And that's that, not to say that
no,
it's a major driver.
But I think I think the whole issue of Trump and corruption in real estate is on a different plane.
Oh, for sure. I'm not saying like he is responsible for Vancouver's faulty market, but it's not even the same
as the casino stuff.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that stuff's wild, too.
You know, and really the issue there is not them spending their money. It's what kinds of people are giving the Trump empire money.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring it up wasn't to like zero in on foreign investors. It was to kind of tie in that idea of the casino problem where a lot of money is sloshing around, and we are a joke in the international law enforcement community, where they call our legal system the Vancouver model, which is embarrassing. And so, like, with that amount of money that is flowing around the local economy, that's the reason why I was curious as to whether.
But we don't know really how much it is. I mean, everyone focuses on, you know, Peter Brown's $31 million house sold to a student, or this day at this particular casino. The market in Vancouver is, I don't know, $750 billion or something like that.
YVR housing analyst, and if he or she's listening, they'll be able to correct me. I think they said something like, you know, 80,000 homes get sold in Metro Vancouver every 6 months or something like that.
Yeah.
Like there's so much sloshing.
I mean,
around.
The whole problem with people focusing on those particular examples is, yeah, they're terrible. They shouldn't happen. Obviously, you know, who wants that in their city? You know, under any circumstances. But what is the impact? It sounds like a lot to average people like us, you know, who have to consider whether we're going to buy a second latte for the day or whether that's too much of an extravagance. So, of course, it sounds like a lot of money. But in terms of the entire real estate market, what is the impact? And to tell you the honest truth, we don't know.
Well, maybe to pivot just before we move into some of our quick questions to wrap this bit up, because I was just looking at my clock and I know you were quite tired from flying all around the country or the continent yesterday. One of the things we're seeing in this election, we've sort of touched on it a couple times, is a growing number of young people getting involved. You look at, I've been keeping this list of who's putting their names forward to run for different council nominations, and you look at the NPA list, and there's all these young, mostly men, but young people. One city has a bunch of young names like Christine Boyle. And what do you think the impact of that, like, generational change or youthquake is going to be?
I mean, I think people are really excited about it, and it is happening in other fields. Like, I was speaking at Larry Beasley, at Larry Beasley's planning class at UBC a couple of weeks ago. He's the former chief planner for Vancouver. He teaches out there now and works as an international consultant. And we were talking, I was saying, you know, one of the things all you young people have to be prepared for is that you may be speaking to reporters within 1 or 2 years of graduating from here. And that's unusual. But I said, I'm noticing more and more young people are, you know, out at council. They are the engineer or the planner or the policy person making the presentation. And, you know, Larry agreed with that because he said what happened was the boomers stayed in place for a long time, and for a long time they dominated everything. And even the Gen Xers sort of couldn't get a break. They've now they're retiring en masse or have already retired. And what you have is this incredible wave of young people, millennials and younger Gen Xers, who now have the stage because finally the old people took off.
Well, and that's, I guess, where abundant housing came out, where I remember I actually was at the council meeting where abundant housing was formed out of, which was
Don't Have 1 Million, the the original first housing protest group with Evangeline Shia. You know, that was millennials.
And I was sort of hoping to talk a little bit about sort of this like movement of these of what's coming out of it in terms of the housing campaign is like. You know, we had this rental development at 18th and Commercial come up that was supposed to be built, and the neighborhood came out against it. And a bunch of us, all independently, without even knowing each other, came in and spoke in favor of that development. I spoke in favor of it as well. And then we all went out for a beer afterwards, and the next thing you know, Abundant Housing is founded. And then after that, now they've got a city councilor elected. Well, I mean, that backs their vision. They're running candidates for multiple parties.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, they have candidates in every party.
Yeah, and there's a voice in every party. I went to, the last Abundant Housing Vancouver event I went to, you know, Adrian Crook was there, who's running for NPA, Tanya Paz was there, who's running for Vision, and Brandon Yen was there, who's running for
One City. Yeah.
And so it's, and they're not necessarily members of Abundant Housing, but, you know, it's, these are people that are friends with that group, right?
Well, and, you know, I've said this a few times on Twitter, and I'll keep saying it, like, this is a profoundly revolutionary change of the kind, even bigger than the basement suites. because I've been covering City Hall public hearings for 25 years. And for all of that time until last year, pretty much, it was dominated by neighborhood groups who were worried about change coming to their neighborhoods. And, you know, every so often, if it was a special needs residential facility, you know, the people who ran that facility or that charitable group would come out. Or if it was a social housing project, someone would come out and say, you know, what about the poor people? They deserve to live here too. But I never would see someone saying, hey, I represent future residents who would like to live here. And, you know, what about our point of view? Like, I actually, like many people, I think just forgot about, you know, the fact that there were all these people who would like to be residents of that neighborhood coming in. And you just have no sense, unless you've spent, you know, 25, 30, 40 years covering this, what a big difference it is. Because really... What happened was, you know, until like the mid 60s, city governments just ran everything as though they were Joseph Stalin, to bring his name up one more time.
Like Robert Moses.
You know, and the city planner here, Gerald Sutton Brown, I mean, he planned the freeway through Vancouver.
14 lanes in downtown Vancouver.
He also, on the plus side, he is the person who encouraged development in the West End. We should all say thank you, Gerald Sutton Brown. There should be a park named after him in the West End, because if it weren't for him, we wouldn't have all those 50s, 60s, and 70s apartments. Team, the revolutionary party of the 70s, the kind of counter the bureaucrats, counter the NPA, got elected. They immediately stopped development in the West End. Immediately. And they privileged neighborhood groups. They said, we're, you know, we want to listen to you, whatever the neighborhood groups want, that's what we support. So all kinds of development in other areas like Langara, Kitsilano, West Point Grey, you know, you see the odd tower in those areas. So those were built before TEAM came in. As soon as TEAM came in, it was what the neighborhood wants, that's what we support.
There's this, in Kitsilano, there's this, you know, civic history plaque that talks about how there were people in the late 70s, early 80s that were laying down in front of bulldozers to preserve Kitsilano. And I, every time I see it, I want to go up and be this is why no one can afford to live here.
I know. They saw themselves as really heroic. And in many ways, they were. I mean, I'm glad they saved a lot of those older things. It's just that they seem to have no concept of how to integrate denser development somewhere in that. And David Lay, you know, who, as we know, is not a fan of current development in Vancouver, the UBC geography professor, he has made the point that these Kits residents is just one example. They shut down development in Kits and effectively kept people out. He said that to the Upper Kits Residents Association. You can imagine.
Oh, wow.
Well, and it shocks me that there's single detached housing that is, you know, a 7-minute bike ride from the Central Business District in downtown Vancouver.
Yes.
You know, that's where all the jobs are, you know? Like, Kits is practically sandwiched in between downtown Vancouver's all the jobs and Broadway Corridor's all the jobs and UBC's where all the job, where all these jobs are. And yet it's still this protected neighborhood.
Yeah, and I've had people come here from other cities who are like, let me get it straight. People are angry because they have to pay $2 million for a house that is 10 minutes from downtown, has a yard and a view of the mountains and the sea. And they think that somehow they have a God-given right to have that for $600,000. Like, you know, people from Toronto where $2 million buys you a semi-detached, you know, next to a busy road kind of thing.
But that was the dogma of politics, I think, in Vancouver from the 70s until maybe 2 years ago. And now it seems like that's on its head. And now it's, no, we should allow these things. And no, we need to do this.
I mean, I think the thing now is for people to try to understand what the overall view is. I'm not one of those people who thinks, you know, there's been a call to have like a big city plan, comprehensive city plan that would like rezone every single lot in the city so that we all know where we're going. I think that's like bureaucratically impossible. And by the time you finish doing it, everyone would have changed their minds anyway. But I do think the next step for everyone who's involved in this is to say what their vision is. You know, it's clearly not just rezoning the West Side, but is there a mechanism for inserting some slightly denser developments into single family neighborhoods? And so on. So, you know, that's going to be, again, a dilemma for whoever gets elected or for the leaders of the two sides, you know, what they put forward as their vision.
Well, we put out there on Twitter for people to ask questions if they had them for you. And
no, this isn't my natural hair color.
No.
I knew that was going to be
a question.
It
doesn't translate well through podcast format, but surprisingly for Van Rie Twitter, we got a lot of really smart questions, and
I am stunned.
That was,
and so we thought we'd sort of run through them, but in a more lightning round. So the first is from @SustainableCollect. They say Vancouver hasn't had an independent mayor in decades, but it's plausible outcome this time. They're interested to hear how that might change the dynamic on city council and how it operates. Presumably, councillors still being partisan. What would be the biggest differences?
So I think it's going to be very hard to elect an independent mayor. Mike Harcourt was the only one. And really, he had been on council before. He was closely affiliated with the left.
He doesn't have the name recognition problems that I guess Shauna Sylvester probably
does. That's right. It will make things a lot more difficult. And I know, not that anyone who's listening cares about this, but I know developers are like pooping their pants over this, because if you have an independent mayor and no clear majority on council, there's just no sense of how things, what their positions are going to be on anything.
And it's, it becomes a lot easier, I think, for a special interest group to hijack the narrative, because everybody is You can just have to form a coalition of voters.
That's right. So, you know, and some people might say, well, that's how a lot of the suburban councils work because they don't have parties. But everybody actually knows that all of those councillors have affiliations with each other, and they kind of know how votes are going to go down on any particular issue. So this will be, if there's an independent plus, you know, no clear majority, it's going to be a period unlike anything else in Vancouver's history.
All right. So Grids Vancouver asks, Francis has been at this for a long time. It would be great to hear about previous big changes to Vancouver housing policy, secondary suites, laneway houses, and others. What led up to those? Who were the main advocates or opponents? And how was the context similar or different to today?
So I still think today's change is far more profound. Because with secondary suites, you know, there was a kind of battle that was fought in Vancouver for 10 years, and finally they just legalized it. And the same thing in a lot of the suburban areas. And laneway houses, well, that was part of, you know, Sam's eco-density. It's the only thing that really got passed. And, you know, there was some opposition, but because it was, you know, sort of subtle enough, more people more or less accepted it. The kinds of changes that young people in abundant housing, YIMBY, or, you know, other housing groups who want real limitations on demand, these are new topics. This is a new field. I think we're at the beginning of a 10-year debate on how to make some profound changes in our city. And like with secondary suites, you know, we'll argue probably for 10 years and then there'll be some kind of resolution or moving forward with little incremental steps along the way.
You brought up Detroit and Cleveland as places where the demand curve has pulled back somewhat. It just made me think, oh, well, that's an interesting policy solution. Maybe we could make the city worse.
Well, I mean, you know, realistically, you want prices to go down. Like, let's have a terrorist incident or, you know, a gigantic economic cataclysm.
I'm so glad I asked this question.
Well, you know, I mean,
yeah,
that's
a bit
flip.
I know
flip.
You're being a little...
That's a bit flip. But
no one's running on ISIS 2018.
But realistically, those are the things that typically bring housing prices down, along with, you know, a collapse of a general housing speculative bubble. But if you're talking about one particular city bringing it down, there has to be something that profoundly influences the economic structure.
So the next question we've got here is from at D. Brokenshire.
And him. Yeah, he's a new arrival, I think, on the scene.
And he says, "Who are the most?" And I'm gonna adjust the question a little bit. He says, "Who are the most influential people in municipal politics in Vancouver?" And whose calls? And he just says, "In general, would every official take?" But I would say, other than the sort of the names that we already know, other than, you know, if Wall calls somebody up, or if
Rob
McDonald or Bob Rennie calls somebody up, obviously they take the phone call. But who's somebody that we wouldn't think of that's actually, you know, got quite a bit of pull in City Hall?
Well, you know, under the Vision Council, certain people who are advocates for particular interests, I think, would get, their calls returned. I think, you know, there's been a real sensitivity to Indigenous groups. Since they now control big chunks of land in Vancouver.
Good point, actually.
I think that, you know, a call from them anytime. You know, not every developer is successful in having their calls returned. I would say Ian Gillespie is favored. And unlike what some people think, it's not because he gives a huge amount of money. In fact, if you look at his contributions, he donates about less than what it costs to rent him his Christmas lights at his hotel, you know, and things like that.
It's
a good point.
But the thing that councils of all stripes have always really liked about him is he comes in and says, what can I do for you that will make you guys look good? I'll give it to you if you give me what I want.
The best way to do advocacy, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, other development companies who I won't name, but they're very big and they're very prominent, they've done nothing but fight with every person at City Hall for 20 or 30 years, and no one wants to talk to them, and you know, it's just a brawl all the time. I'm trying to think of Who else? I'd have to think about that one some more.
Well, I think that was a really fascinating answer, mm-hmm. especially the First Nations and the Indigenous analysis mm-hmm. there. Yeah.
At Laurel Janine writes that you've probably touched on this in some recent tweets, but she wants to hear about some highs and lows of reporting on City of Vancouver planning issues. For example, a project that was opposed when it was proposed, but is now widely loved, or the most virulent opposition to social/non-market housing proposals.
Wow, that's a really good question, and I would really like to reread my 4,667 stories to come up with a good answer for that. I mean, this isn't really a planning issue, but the building of the Canada Line really taught me something, which was up until the day the doors opened, it was largely negative coverage. It was unbelievable how negative it was. Businesses were being ruined. We were spending way too much money. And the minute it opened and people started taking it and it was hugely successful, all of a sudden, everyone talked about what a great transit advance it was and how it had really changed the city and convinced people to use transit and, you know, increased ridership and so on. So to me, that was a very good reminder of how much Vancouverites hate big projects right up until they open.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point.
Marvelous. All right. So finally, this is a question a little more on journalism. How has journalism changed in the brave new world of social media and podcasts?
Journalism, you'd never ask.
Journalism not only
been asked this question a few times.
No.
And finally, journalism not only reports on politics, but by its reporting influences politics. How does that relationship affect your journalism? Can it be objective, and should it even try?
Okay, so there's a lot of questions packed into there.
Yeah,
I don't think any journalist.
That's what you can do with 280 characters.
Yes. I don't think any responsible journalist ever claims to be completely objective. It's impossible. Nobody can be. A judge can't be, you know, whatever. You do your best. My personal philosophy has always been I do my best to give a voice to everyone who's involved in a conversation and to report them in as strong a way as I can. Like when I was younger, I used to have colleagues who would be like, oh, I just wait for them to say something stupid. And then that's what I put in the story, you know. They wanted to make people they disagreed with look stupid. And I always think that's a real failing because you want everyone to understand why is this group attracting people? What is their strongest argument? So I don't claim to be objective, but I do hope that everyone that I've ever dealt with understands that I would always give them a place in the story try to. Like, you don't do it in every story. I get 600 words per story. So, you know, obviously I can't cram everything in all the time. And I think that generally most journalists are still holding to that. And most journalists are trying to engage with people that they meet through social media. In some ways, I love social media. I've had the best laughs. I've had the most support. I love, sort of having all these conversations with all these people in Vancouver. It's fantastic. Like, I get to talk to way more people than I used to. The downside, which is not original in any way, is that it can be so vicious and so nasty and so personal. And I now tell my students, you have to be prepared for this. You're going to get attacked. You're going to feel as though, you know, there's a bullseye on your forehead and people are going to come after you. They're going to say things that aren't true. They're going to libel you out in public online. And they're going to make it really personal. And that is what has happened for me is that, you know, in the last...
We've really seen it online.
Yeah.
Know, several of the HALT people especially, or not as a HALT, but the people of that realm, I've definitely seen a lot of attack at you.
Yeah.
Let's not say that some people libel people.
But they do. Actually, that
is
a problem.
Yes, I know that some people do, but specific people, we shouldn't say that.
I know that you've even commented when others have libeled others.
I've tried to warn people.
You said,
like,
you know, this is textbook libel in a response.
Yeah. And, you know, something that's happened to me that had never happened in the other 35 years of my career is I've had activists write to my editors suggesting that I'm doing certain things that if there was a shred of truth to it, I would be fired instantly. Right. I had never had any.
And that's an ugliness to politics that I'm not happy with.
You know, I can see people saying, she's, you know, I think she's biased, or I think she's unfairly going after so-and-so. But to like write to someone and say, this reporter is doing this completely unethical thing with no evidence is just so amazing to me. I still kind of can't get over it. So that's what's changed.
So as a follow-up to that, from the first part of your answer, do you think that there is a bias toward balance in journalism? Like the idea that, you know, everyone has a story to tell and everyone has a point of view is absolutely valid. But like, how do you balance that with the idea that, you know, in sometimes some groups, as you just mentioned, are just lying?
Well, you know, that's been a debate in journalism for a long time and really came to a head during the Joe McCarthy era, mm-hmm. where reporters were struggling with the fact that McCarthy would go out and say anything he wanted, and then they would write it down, and then they'd put in the other side or whatever. But they knew that it wasn't really representing the problems, or it wasn't really representing things fairly, because he was saying things that were untrue. And I've heard this debate over and over at journalism conferences. The problem when you just, oh, let's just do both sides, like for climate change, you know, do you believe in climate change and don't you believe in climate change without, you know, and there's a problem when you make it sound like those are two evenly balanced sides, instead of which 98% of scientists are on one side and only 2% are on the other. So,
And they work for oil companies.
Yeah. So I think, you know, again, anyone who's a responsible journalist, you're looking for different voices, but you also need to try to give the audience a sense of, you know, those voices in relation to each other and, you know, whether they're actually factual or not, and so on. I do think one thing that's happening right now is because media feel under siege and they're trying to attract audiences and they feel that they need to do hard-hitting, somewhat sensational things to do that, there's a bit more of a tendency to do investigative or things that look investigative. In other words, you're just attacking somebody in order to attract readers, because a lot of readers, there's a lot of anger in society these days about inequity, you know, which is expressed through the housing situation, but all kinds of inequality, situations. And so some media, I think, are wanting to attract readers who by sort of, you know, publishing things that confirm their anger, or where these angry readers can go to have their feelings confirmed.
And hit pieces get clicks, so.
Mm-hmm. They do. Yeah.
Great. Well, I think that's all the questions we have for you.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Thank you so much for sitting for a solid hour after. I know it was a really hectic set of flights you took to get here.
Yeah, a long conference.
This has been really, really entertaining and illuminating.
Yeah. For people who want to find more of your work and aren't already following you on Twitter, like 16,000 other people, where can they find you?
So my Twitter handle is at Fabula, F-A-B-U-L-A, Vancouver, Fabula. That's my real initials and name. But Fabula is also a word that means story. So I love that.
I did not know that. Yes. I was wondering about that.
Yeah. My blog is Francis Beulah at francisbeulah.com, and I write for The Globe, sometimes BC Business and Vancouver Magazine, but I post everything onto my blog, so it's all there.
And are you still doing the plumber articles there that you had?
No, I just did that for a short while, and it was just too much to keep going on a regular basis. Yeah, I tried to answer just general questions people had about the city, like Toronto Life, and a lot of city magazines, they do something like that, like, why is this weird sign in this intersection or whatever, and you know, if people ask me a question, I'll still answer it, but I don't go out of my way to do it every week or every month.
Right.
Thanks again for joining us, Francis. Remember to subscribe to Cambie Report. Leave us a review. We're getting a ton of great reviews on iTunes. I saw a couple more. Someone from Alberta who says we're a good way to discover Vancouver politics, which was super nice. You can find us at cambiereport.ca. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Cambie Report. And I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Matthew Naylor.
Thank you.